This week on COVID Race and Democracy.
The U.S. sanctions are a form of hybrid warfare. The U.S. is using sanctions instead of guns.
How U.S. sanctions are deadly, destructive, and internationally condemned.
Despite the support for the document, we are not convinced that international restrictive measures will be an appropriate response to the whole raft of complex problems in Haiti.
The UN Security Council has approved new sanctions on Haitians.
It is a form of full, all-out colonial policy or neo-colonial policy. And if you read between the lines, they do not want Ethiopia to go in a direction other than the U.S.
U.S. officials threaten Ethiopia with further sanctions as the Ethiopian Defense Force nears victory in the two-year Ethiopian civil war. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. This is part three of our Sanctions Kill series. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Modern-day economic sanctions and blockades are comparable with medieval sieges of towns with the intention of forcing them to surrender. 21st century sanctions attempt to bring not just a town, but sovereign countries to their knees. A difference, perhaps, is that 21st century sanctions are accompanied by the manipulation of public opinion through fake news, aggressive public relations, and a pseudo-human rights rhetoric, so as to give the impression that a human rights end justifies the criminal means. Those are the words of Alfred de Zayas, UN Human Rights Council independent expert on the promotion of a democratic and equitable international order. In recent decades, the U.S. foreign policy establishment has increasingly used sanctions to impose their will on other nations. I spoke to Rick Sterling of the Sanctions Kill Coalition about the coalition's newly updated report, How U.S. Sanctions Are Deadly, Destructive, and Internationally Condemned. Rick Sterling, sanctions is a very broad term. Could you summarize the types of sanctions that the U.S. imposes?
Yes. U.S. sanctions can be applied against individuals, against companies, and against entire governments. For example, there's an individual named Alex Saab. He's a diplomat from Venezuela. He's in prison in Florida after being seized in Cape Verde, charged with facilitating Venezuela from circumventing U.S. sanctions, which prohibited the import of food, medicines, and other goods like that. You've got companies that are under U.S. sanctions that have been penalized around the world, and you've got entire governments which are under U.S. sanctions, and the leaders of those governments specifically are sometimes targeted. For example, in the case of Nicaragua, the entire leadership of the government, or the major leaders of the government, were individually sanctioned. In one case, there was a very effective minister of health, a woman doctor, and she couldn't do her job leading the country's health policy because she couldn't sign contracts and she couldn't participate in international agreements about healthcare issues. So she finally had to step down from her position. So the sanctions greatly disrupt the normal operations. And another form of sanctions is actually it's effectively the theft of the country's resources. One example is Venezuela, where over $1 billion in gold that was being held at the Bank of England has been seized, has been appropriated, and the U.S. and the U.K. want to turn that wealth of the Venezuelan people over to their puppet, who they pretend is the government of Venezuela. They also did the same stunt with Afghanistan, where $7 billion in national wealth belonging to the Afghan people was seized in England. And now President Biden has declared that $3.5 billion of that belongs to the Afghan people is going to be distributed to U.S. victims of 9/11. So you've got a lot of extreme cases where the impact of sanctions is horrific. At the United Nations, U.S. sanctions are referred to as unilateral coercive measures. They are unilateral in that they are not imposed by the United Nations or some other collective body. They are applied unilaterally. Sometimes the U.S. is alone in applying the sanctions. Sometimes they've got support from their allies. But in any case, they are not approved by the United Nations. And in some cases, almost the entire world is vehemently opposed to the U.S. sanctions, such being the case with Cuba. Of course, the U.S. has had sanctions and an embargo against Cuba for over 60 years. But in short, sanctions is an increasingly prevalent way that the U.S. uses to try to control countries and to punish countries which do things which the U.S. doesn't agree with. There are now some 40 different countries under some form of U.S. sanctions.
Okay, what about secondary sanctions?
These are what give the real muscle to sanctions, because the U.S. claims the right to impose these sanctions, and they require all governments and companies around the world to comply with them. So in the case of U.S. sanctions against Cuba, for example, Cuba and Iran are heavily sanctioned by the United States. And so the U.S. says that no international organization or corporation can facilitate trade with Cuba and Iran, and will be heavily penalized if they do so. In 2015, the fourth largest bank in the world, the French bank Paribas, was convicted in U.S. court of violating these rules and was fined $8.9 billion because they facilitated trade from Cuba and Iran with other countries. So even if the transaction had nothing to do with the U.S., it was from Iran or Cuba with some third party. Secondary sanctions mean that they apply to anyone or any company or any country in the world. So it's really extensive, and that's what makes them so destructive. In the case of Syria, the U.S. sanctions say that the Syrian Central Bank is a, quote, money laundering institute, and that no company or other bank or government should deal with it. So a semi-socialist country like Syria, which has national health care and which is responsible for all the schooling, the education, pharmaceutical factories, and so forth in the country, they're not allowed to rebuild. And under U.S. sanctions, any company or government which attempts to assist Syria or trade with them or invest in the rebuilding of pharmaceutical plants or schools or hospitals, they're prohibited from doing so. So it shows the extraterritorial nature of the U.S. sanctions.
Did the bank, Paribas, did they just roll over and pay these billions of dollars in fines for facilitating trade between Cuba and Iran?
Well, they had to. Ultimately, yes, they paid $8.9 billion because if they ever want to deal with the U.S. economy again, they had to. And of course, this put a huge scare in any other bank or any other corporation which wants to deal with the victim of U.S. sanctions, because the U.S. can go after them and can penalize them or block them, prevent them from doing any business in the United States.
Okay, the report says that 70% of the nations in the world consider sanctions a violation of international law. How is that 70% determined?
Well, that was 70% of the United Nations General Assembly. It was in a resolution that was put forward in December 2020, and it was very similar to resolutions which have been previously passed for more than a decade. The vast majority of the UNGA has been condemning U.S. sanctions. By the way, that 70% of nations is more like 85 or 86% of humanity, because it includes many of the largest countries of the world. So it's a huge majority of countries and people in the world which condemn U.S. sanctions.
Okay, can we go through the five conclusions in your report?
Yes, please.
Okay, your first conclusion is, quote, sanctions are collective punishment and undermine peaceful relations among nations. Could you explain and share several examples?
Well, it's collective punishment in that it's the entire population of the country that's being victimized that are hurt. And it's usually the poor that are hurt the most. It's not the government of Nicaragua that suffers, it's the people of the country, or in the case of Cuba, it's the average Cuban citizen that feels the consequences of the extreme U.S. embargo and sanctions on Cuba, which have been going on for 60 years. There have been many, many investigations into the consequences, the on-the-ground consequences and real-life impact of the sanctions. The United Nations has promoted many investigations, and they have a UN expert that's looked into this in many different cases, and they have invariably found that the sanctions hurt the poor the most. In the case of Venezuela, the Center for Economic and Political Research in Washington, D.C. investigated the consequences of U.S. sanctions on Venezuela, and they found that in just 2 years, over 40,000 citizens had died as a result of the consequences of the U.S. sanctions, which greatly impeded the arrival and the distribution of medicine and food and so forth. The U.S. even hijacked an Iranian freighter that was heading to Venezuela to supply diesel fuel when they were short of diesel, which was needed for powering water pumps and tractors and trucks for taking supplies and food and medicines around the country. When they were short of that, Iran sent a ship that was laden with diesel fuel. The U.S. hijacked that on the high seas, took it to Houston, and auctioned off the diesel fuel just to prevent Venezuela from acquiring that. So the U.S. sanctions are, you know, a form of hybrid warfare. The U.S. is using sanctions instead of guns to kill tens of thousands of Venezuelans in a fruitless effort that is intended to induce regime change, I suppose, but is failing.
Okay, your second conclusion is, quote, the Western public is unaware of the misery caused by U.S. sanctions because Western media doesn't report it. I assume this applies to sanctions on the developing world, since most Westerners are now at least somewhat aware of how sweeping sanctions on Russia are affecting their lives. Could you elaborate?
Yeah, I'm convinced that most residents and citizens of the United States and North America have no idea what the real-life consequences are of the U.S. sanctions on third-world countries who are the primary victims. They're unaware of it because the media never reports it. Previously, I mentioned that at the United Nations, U.S. sanctions are called unilateral coercive measures. So I was curious to see how much the New York Times had talked about unilateral coercive measures and how much they have been condemned at the United Nations and how much they've reported on the independent expert reports that have been promoted by the United Nations and various international organizations. And it was stunning to find that the New York Times, according to their archives, has never once referred to unilateral coercive measures. So they don't report on that finding, for example, of the CEPR that 40,000 Venezuelans were dead as a result of sanctions over 2 years. They don't report on the real-life consequences. I'm pretty convinced that if the average person in the United States knew about this, that they would oppose it. They would be saying, why are we doing this? And they don't know about it, and so they can't object.
Okay, now your third conclusion is that, quote, sanctions against Russia are backfiring on the West. Talk about that.
Yes, the sanctions, the extreme sanctions were imposed on Russia in late February after Russia's intervention in Ukraine. There have been many sanctions on Russia, especially going back to 2014, but the extreme sanctions were beginning in February of this year. And Western leaders at the time made it very explicit that they intended to greatly damage the Russian economy. And some of them even talked about damaging it to the point that they hoped that people would rise up in Russia and overthrow the Putin government. And what's actually happened is that Russia has, instead of exporting its gas and minerals and other reserves to Western Europe and North America, they've looked east and they've exported the same products to Asia, especially China and India, two countries which have huge populations of about 1.4 billion people. And so they're very happy to receive the cheap gas and the minerals and so forth from Russia. So, and as a consequence, there's a huge shortage. There's been a skyrocketing price of fuel. There's been inflation overall. And we've seen the inflation in the United States. Of course, gas prices have gone up dramatically in the last 6 months, and that's largely caused by the sanctions against Russia that were imposed by Biden and the European Union. Meanwhile, the Russian economy, which they intended to greatly damage, has turned out to be much stronger than they realized. The ruble initially fell in value internationally, but very quickly rebounded, and it's actually worth more now than it has been in the past. And at the same time, in Western Europe, the factories are shutting down. They're talking about an actual deindustrialization of Germany. And throughout Western Europe, they're seeing huge negative consequences of the imposition of sanctions against Russia. Now, meanwhile, at the same time, there are U.S. corporations which are hugely profiting from this. For example, the LNG, liquefied natural gas suppliers, are filling in for some of the losses that they've experienced by cutting off cheap Russian gas. But the U.S. LNG is being sold at 7 times the price that they used to obtain it from Russia. Now, meanwhile, some weeks ago, of course, the Nord Stream gas pipelines from Russia to Germany were sabotaged. And it doesn't take much insight to know who was behind that, who had the motive, the means, and the opportunity. In fact, in January, Biden said they would not allow the Nord Stream to operate if Russia intervened in Ukraine, which they did. And Biden evidently knew what he was talking about, because those gas pipelines, which would have provided lots of cheap gas to Germany, and then beyond that to other countries in Western Europe, that option doesn't exist, although it possibly could be repaired, but that's not determined yet.
Okay, fourth, you conclude that, quote, sanctions are designed to maintain U.S. global hegemony. Talk about that.
Well, there's a mask and a pretense of sanctions. They talk about it being against corruption. They talk about it being against authoritarianism. If you look at the congressional resolutions on sanctions, they will say that it's for good things. I think behind the mask, the real reason the U.S. imposes sanctions is because countries are doing things which the U.S. disapproves of. Anybody who thinks that the U.S. government is very much against corruption or against dictatorship doesn't know very much about U.S. history, which is replete with examples where they were quite happy with the Pinochet dictatorship in Chile, which the U.S. helped to bring into power. They're very happy with the dictatorship in the Philippines, the Marcos dictatorship. They're very happy with dictatorships in Africa and in Central America and so forth. So there's a pretense of why the U.S. imposes sanctions. There's a reality. In her book, Hard Choices, Hillary Clinton writes about her time as Secretary of State, and she's pretty frank about sanctions. It's the stick. She talks about the carrot and the stick, basically beating countries into line. And sanctions are the tool. Of course, they also use military weapons, and they fund surrogate armies at times as well. But it's sanctions that are applied widely. And increasingly, the thing about sanctions is that this has increased dramatically as a tool or as a weapon of U.S. foreign policy over the last couple of decades.
Okay, is there anything else you'd like to say?
Well, the updated sanctions report will be available soon. And I also want to tell listeners there's going to be a book about sanctions, which analyzes many of the specific examples and many aspects of sanctions. And both of these are going to be available from the Sanctions Kill Coalition. Look at their website, sanctionskill.org.
That was Rick Sterling, co-author of the Sanctions Kill Coalition's newly updated report, How U.S. Sanctions Are Deadly, Destructive, and Internationally Condemned.
Oh, mama, mama, look there. Your children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns are jammed downtown. The killing clowns are blood money men. Shooting those Washington bullets again. As every cell in Chile will tell cries of the tortured men. Remember Allende and the days before, before the army came. Please remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium. Es verdad. Those Washington bullets again.
That was The Clash, Washington Bullets. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. In Haiti, there is a popular insurrection unfolding in the streets amidst a critical shortage of fuel, food, and water for millions of people and a new outbreak of cholera. According to Haitian authorities, a coalition of gangs has prevented the distribution of diesel and petrol for more than a month to protest a plan to cut fuel subsidies. Ever since Haiti won its independence from France in 1804, the country has faced waves of invasions. In reference to the current popular insurrection in Haiti, Vijay Prashad of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research says, quote, "These protests are the continuation of a cycle of resistance that began in 2016 in response to a social crisis developed by the coups in 1991 and 2004, the earthquake in 2010, and Hurricane Matthew in 2016. For more than a century, any attempt by the Haitian people to exit the neocolonial system imposed by the U.S. military occupation between 1915 and 1934 has been met with military and economic interventions to preserve it. The structures of domination and exploitation established by that system have impoverished the Haitian people, with most of the population having no access to drinking water, health care, education, or decent housing. Of Haiti's 11.4 million people, 4.6 million are food insecure, and 70% are unemployed. The UN Security Council on Friday unanimously approved a sanctions regime for Haiti, targeting alleged gang leaders and those who financed them. After the vote, the U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas Greenfield, stated that the sanctions resolution was only the first step and that more intervention is in the works.
The United States and Mexico are working on a resolution that would authorize a non-UN international security assistance mission to help improve the security situation and enable the flow of desperately needed humanitarian aid. This is not only a response to a request from the government of Haiti, but also one of the options that the Secretary General recommended the Security Council consider in light of the deteriorating security environment.
The Chinese ambassador to the UN expressed support for the resolution, despite being opposed to sanctions as a go-to mechanism.
China has always called for caution with regard to the use or threat of use of sanctions, irrespective of the circumstances in international relations. But considering the urgency of the current situation in Haiti and the call of the people, China was the first within the Council to propose targeted sanctions on Haitian criminal gangs. Haiti is at the brink of a collapse and is in dire need of international help. We hope that in the next stage of our discussion on this issue, we will continue to uphold the spirit of consultation and unity.
Russia's representative stated that reaching consensus on the sanctions resolution was not easy.
Despite the support for the document, we are not convinced that international restrictive measures will be an appropriate response to the whole raft of complex problems in Haiti. A long-term solution, in one way or another, must be found in a political process and socioeconomic development, in eradicating poverty and inequality. There's a need to ensure strengthening of state institutions in the country without external dictates, and this is something that runs through almost all of its contemporary history.
Pacifica's Polina Vasiliev spoke to Ajamu Baraka, national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace and contributing columnist to Black Agenda Report.
Ajamu, so how should we see the proposed solution for the crisis in Haiti, sanctions and perhaps more, coming out of the United Nations and led by the U.S. and Mexico?
We should see it as another attempt on the part of powerful Western nations to once again attempt to impose its will on Haiti and the Haitian people. The people of Haiti are quite clear. They see the crisis in their country, not a crisis resulting from the higher prices, the cholera, or any of those realities. What they see is a crisis of imperialism. because they believe that they can deal with all of the issues that they face collectively as a people and a nation if they have the ability to exercise authentic national sovereignty and self-determination. They have been in the streets to protest against the fact that these powerful outside forces, the United States, the groups that make up the core group, this intervention that has undermined the ability of the people to take a full handle on their sovereignty, that's the real problem. So we say in the Black Alliance of Peace, we believe that progressive forces that believe in authentic anti-colonialism should stand with the Haitian people, and that stand with these attempts to lay the foundation for the justification for yet another invasion of Haiti and occupation.
Okay, can you talk about how U.S. and European economic sanctions on Russia have contributed to the fuel and food crisis that Haiti's people are suffering now? Also, curious that Russian flags have been flying all over the demonstrations in Port-au-Prince, from what I've heard.
Well, look, I think people in the Global South are making the correct connections between the transference of the costs of the war in Ukraine to the working classes and the colonized people in the Global South. They understand that it's been the blowback from the sanctions regime that has impacted global supply chains, that is responsible for the increase in the price of fuel and food. They also are quite aware of the pressure that was put on the unelected government by the International Monetary Fund to remove the last of the fuel subsidies that resulted in fuel costs going through the roof. So they understand the structural connections. And so this war in Ukraine and the consequences of it for people in the Global South, and indeed people even in the northern nations, people understand that that is the source of much of the suffering that they are facing, including the runaway inflation. So unlike Publix in the North, Publix in the U.S., that can sometimes be confused by the propaganda apparatus, the people in Haiti are quite sophisticated, and they understand the connections that are responsible for the political and economic crisis that they face in their nation.
So the UN Security Council on Friday unanimously approved a sanctions regime for Haiti, targeting gang leaders and those who finance them. This UN Security Council Resolution 2653, drafted by the US and Mexico, establishes a committee which will be responsible for designating the individuals and entities to be sanctioned. Is a UN regime of targeted sanctions a step in the right direction? And if not, what are the negative effects of such a measure on the civilian population? I mean, we have to remember that the US and Canada have been arming the Haiti National Police, against which people are protesting as much as against gang violence.
Well, you know, people are mixed on how to read the sanction regime. I think people are more concerned with the fact that this is the first step in providing the justification for a full-blown invasion. First, you sanction the so-called gang leaders, and you strengthen the argument that in order to decapitate the leadership of the gangs, you have to have a security force to, in fact, do that. So while some people think that this is a progressive step, again, for the Haitian people, it suggests that if they are allowed to address their own internal issues, that they will solve the gang issue. For them, the issue of the gangs are secondary. For them, it is the continuation of this oligarchy that is responsible for the suffering of the people in that country. They're more concerned with displacing that element because they understand that some of the gangs are, in fact, being financed by these powerful members of the Haitian oligarchy. So they're not going to be distracted and confused by this focus on the gangs. In fact, they recognize that the whole gang issue is just the pretext that they are trying to establish to justify this paternalistic, this responsibility to protect hustle that Western powers use when they are prepared or committed to going into a country and undermining the sovereignty of that nation.
So among the sanctioned is an ex-police officer named Jimmy Cherizier. He's a leader of the revolutionary forces of the G9 family. He's also known as Barbecue, a childhood nickname he has had because his parents used to operate the barbecue stand, apparently. While Western media portrays him as a ruthless gangster, the outlet Haiti Liberté reports that Cherizier is a popular leader and organizer. Your thoughts, Ajamu?
That is absolutely correct to see this as a much more complicated and complex situation than how it's portrayed in the Western press. There seems to be authentic support for his organization and for him as an individual. There's no question there's some issues there. But again, these are issues that the Haitian people have to deal with themselves. This notion that he should be targeted is more in alignment with the understanding that in order for the occupation, the invasion and the occupation to be successful, they have to disarm those forces. The problem, of course, is this, that in that process, there are going to be scores of Haitians who are going to lose their lives. There are people walking around today who are alive, who will be dead if this invasion takes place, because the Haitian people have made it quite clear they're going to resist this one. So again, it's not up to people outside of Haiti to make those determinations. That determination in terms of what role he and the G9 will play is up to the Haitian people.
About the role of Mexico vis-a-vis Haiti, the Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has established some progressive and even anti-imperialist credentials, but not vis-a-vis Haiti. The Black Alliance for Peace issued an open letter to AMLO in July of this year, co-signed by many other organizations, on the occasion of the renewal of the UN mission to Haiti, calling it foreign occupation and denial of sovereignty. What should people who want to stand in solidarity with Haitian self-determination and sovereignty be calling for at this time?
They should be calling for the rejection of the Mexican government's providing the political cover for this Western intervention. We said back in July, and we say again today, that there's confusion on the part of the Mexican government, that we reject the notion that there needs to be outside intervention, that we question AMLO's positioning himself as one of the leaders of progressive forces in our region, while simultaneously aligning himself and the Mexican government with the interests of imperialism. So we say we can't have any sentimentality, that while we can be in alignment with AMLO on certain issues, on this one, he should be criticized and the position of the Mexican government should be rejected.
Ajamu Baraka, thank you so much for speaking to Pacifica Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
That was Ajamu Baraka, national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace and contributing columnist to Black Agenda Report, speaking with Pacifica's Polina Vasiliev.
Chante sa
Mon compère mwen Aoulo, oulo, oulo Mon compère mwen
Waye dem chante sa
Mon compère mwen Aoulo, oulo, oulo Mon compère mwen
Waye dem chante sa
Mon compère mwen Aoulo, oulo, oulo Mon compère mwen
Se chitam chitam nap gade Nous c'est tout pour la vie menacée, vrai. Faut les dem chanter ça.
Mon compère, oui. Aoulo, oulo, oulo, mon compère, oui.
Faut les dem chanter ça.
Mon compère, oui. Aoulo, oulo, oulo, mon compère, oui.
Mouncho, oulo. Fonne dem chante sa
Mon compère, oui Aoulo, oulo, oulo, mon compère, oui
That was Haiti, La Révolution des Noirs. Sweeping U.S. and EU sanctions on Russia are causing inflation and shortages in the West, especially in Europe. Economist Michael Hudson warned back in April about the blowback. Here is part of his conversation with Ross Ashcroft, host of Renegade Inc.
Michael, sanctions is all we hear now. We're sanctioning people, the West sanctioning people back to the Stone Age. What are the unintended consequences of sanctions?
Well, one is to serve very much like a protective tariff on the sanctioned country. For instance, when America made sanctions on European trade with Russia, Lithuania dutifully stopped exporting cheese to Russia. Well, the result is Russia set up its own cheese sector, and now it's self-sufficient in cheese. If you sanction a country, you force it to become more self-reliant. And across the board, from agriculture to dairy products to technology, Russia is forced to become more self-reliant and at the same time to depend much more on trade with China for the things that it is still not self-reliant in. So America is bringing about exactly the opposite of what it intended. Its hope was to somehow isolate Russia and then be able to go after China without Russia. And instead, what it's doing is integrating the Eurasian core, Russia and China, exactly the policy that Henry Kissinger warned against, going all the way back to Mackinder a century ago, that said Eurasia is the world island, and Russia and China could be the whole world center. That's what the fight is all about. Well, American sanctions are driving Russia and China together. And America has gone to China and said, no, please don't support Russia. March 14th, Jake Sullivan came out and told China, we will sanction countries that break our sanctions against Russia. And, basically China said, fine, we'll just break off all the trade between East and West now. And the East and West are, the East and Eurasia is pretty much self-sufficient. The West is not self-sufficient since it began to deindustrialize, and it's heavily dependent on Russia for not only oil and gas, but palladium and many raw materials. So the sanctions are ending up driving a wedge between the European countries.
Don't people who apply these sanctions think this through? Are they so short-sighted that they don't understand that these sanctions are going to build further capacity within Russia, push Russia further towards China, make that economic alliance concrete, and ultimately you're not going to be able to keep the lights on in Europe? All the while, underestimating the fact that from a food security point of view, take the UK, for instance, a net importer of food, appreciating the fact that, for instance, Russia, Ukraine, they create 25%, a quarter of all wheat annually. The estimation this year is 102 million tonnes, Russia and Ukraine, wheat. Don't people realise that there's going to be a massive knock-on effect?
Yes, they do realise it. Yes, they've thought it all through. I've worked with these people for more than 50 years.
Who are these people?
The neocons, basically. The people who are in charge of U.S. Foreign policy. Victoria Nuland and her husband, Robert Kagan. The people that President Biden has appointed all around him, from Blinken to Sullivan and right down the line. They are basically urging the people around the new American century. They're the people who said America can run the whole world and create its own reality. And yes, they know that this is going to cause enormous problems for Germany. They know that not only will it block the energy that Germany and Italy and other countries in Europe need through their oil and gas, but also it'll block the use of gas for fertilizer, upping their fertilizer production and decreasing their food production. They look at this and they say, how can America gain from all of this? There's always a way of gaining from what something looks to be bad. Well, one way they'll gain is oil prices are going way up, and that benefits the United States, whose foreign policy is based very largely on oil, and gas. The oil industry controls most of the world's oil trade, and that explains a lot of the U.S. diplomacy. This is a fight to lock the world energy trade into control by U.S. companies, excluding not only Iran and Venezuela, but also excluding Russia.
That was economist Michael Hudson speaking to Ross Ashcroft, host of Renegade Inc. Alexander Mercouris, editor-in-chief of the Duran, spoke with the Left Lens host Danny Haifong about the economic and political crises in Europe and the blowback from the economic sanctions on Russia.
It's difficult to understand what the thinking of European politicians, and by the way, British politicians, was. But my sense is that when the war in Ukraine began, they thought this crisis would be over very quickly. They thought that once they imposed all these sanctions on Russia, then they are enormously wide-ranging sanctions, that the seizure of the central bank's assets, the sanctioning of the central bank itself, the disconnection of Russian banks from SWIFT, the attacks on Russian oil, the attacks on Russian gas, all of that, that would provoke an economic crisis in Russia, that crisis would lead to the fall of the Russian government, that when the government fell, when Putin himself fell, it was taken as axiomatic that whatever replaced Putin would somehow be better disposed of the West in some way. And somehow everything would then be sorted out. You'd have the access to the gas, you'd have the access to the oil, you'd have all those things. Everything would go back to normal. But of course, the terrible man in the Kremlin would have gone. And in fact, it wouldn't go back to normal. We'd have broken Russia. The problem, the challenge, the difficulty Russia faces would have ended. And somehow that would have been better for all of us. And of course, it hasn't worked out like that, because Russia has turned out to be economically far more resilient than the West, certainly the Europeans, imagined. And not just the Europeans, the US as well. We've had admissions from US officials that that has been the case. And instead of knocking Russia out, knocking Putin out quickly in a few weeks, what they found themselves instead is in a long drawn out war of economic attrition, in which Europe were a victim. But all of these political leaders, Scholz, Macron, the Johnson Truss government in Britain, they don't have a way out because their political reputations are now so invested in this. So we've got this extraordinary situation where we're trapped in an economic war that nobody really imagined or expected. And the political survival of the governments in Europe and of the European Commission as well, by the way, is now tied to the continuation of this economic war to its bitterest end. So we're going down, and there is no sign that the captain has any interest in changing course. And of course, that's creating major problems in France, in Germany, in Britain. We have an economic crisis. It's now becoming a political crisis as well. But the extraordinary thing about the political crisis in Britain is that nobody talks about the way in which it relates to the sanctions, the economic war. Nobody offers any solutions. Nobody is looking for any kind of change, because to do so would be to sort of break the omerta. It would break the discipline of the political class, and it might jeopardize the hold of the political class if that was admitted.
That was Alexander Mercouris, editor-in-chief of the Duran, speaking with the Left Lens host, Danny Haifong.
Western media, you've been spreading lies just to sow confusion, just to destabilize. My sovereign editor, divide and conquer, your quest to take over my sweet home Africa. Mass migration has started, millions have departed, all the minerals you stole, you discounted millions of souls. Sanctions on baseless sanctions,
You'd love to see us kneel, but with the can-do people, we will never yield. And I said, no more, no more, no more. And we said, no more, no more, no more. And I said, no more.
That was No More, a tribute to a movement by Line Tedessa. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. The Ethiopian and Eritrean armies now seem close to winning a two-year war with the Tigray People's Liberation Front, commonly known as the TPLF, a clique that ruled Ethiopia brutally for 27 years, from 1991 to 2018, with U.S. support. The West, most of all the U.S., has given political, diplomatic, and narrative support to the TPLF throughout the war, and imposed sanctions on Ethiopia and Eritrea to try to control its outcome. Now, as Ethiopian and Eritrean forces near victory, the propagandistic attacks on both become more shrill and extreme every day. On October 15th, Senator Robert Menendez, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, vowed to more aggressively pursue passage of his sanctions bill, the Ethiopia Peace and Stabilization Act of 2021, which is in fact a Punishment and Destabilization Act. At a Saturday rally in the nation's capital, Addis Ababa, Ethiopians held up signs that read, "No more to a proxy war. USA, respect Ethiopian sovereignty." And, "We oppose H.R. 6600, and S-3199 bills." H.R. 6600 is the bill in the House. S-3199 is the Menendez bill in the Senate. I spoke to John Philpott, international criminal defense attorney and Sanctions Kill Coalition researcher and activist, about the Menendez bill. The Menendez Senate bill, S-3199, proposes sweeping sanctions to control every aspect of Ethiopian society, its economy, its politics, and even information shared in any public forum, including social media. It's very similar to the House bill, H.R. 6600, but even more draconian. What are your thoughts after reading it?
Well, it is a form of full, all-out colonial policy or neo-colonial policy. And if you read between the lines, they do not want Ethiopia to go in a direction other than the U.S. One thing which comes back throughout this document and the previous documents, they talk about access to humanitarian aid. We know about humanitarian aid vehicles being used to transport arms. The other thing they want to stop is Eritrea's intervention in this war. And we will recall that the war with Eritrea was ended with Mr. Abiy coming to power, and they made peace, and Mr. Abiy got a Nobel Peace Prize for this. Ethiopia has a right to ask Eritrea to help. The U.S. wants to impose as a facilitator in the negotiation. And this is a no-go because it's not neutral. We all know that the U.S. supported the TPLF government from 1991 to 2018. And they are also very broad in their definition of who they can sanction. They talk about Ethiopia or other countries who are helping break the sanctions. They also give themselves power to oppose international loan. And we all know that one of the ways in which countries develop or finance their development is by borrowing money from international banking institutions. Whether we like it or not, this is one way in which countries function. So it's a very strong intervention, and the information is transmitted to the State Department, and they'll be reporting to Congress. So these are all very serious forms of intervention, and we don't know exactly why. But it seems that they're upping the ante right now. The previous version of the law recognized legitimacy of the change of government in 2018. This version doesn't even talk about that. So it may be a sign of desperation by the USA, but it's very dangerous.
The TPLF attacked both Ethiopia and Eritrea at the outset of the war, and the two countries' armies have been fighting together for the past 2 years. One of the Menendez bill's first demands is that, quote, "The government of Eritrea must immediately and completely withdraw its military forces from Ethiopia," unquote. Aren't Ethiopia and Eritrea's right to collective defense codified in Article 51 of the UN Charter?
Yes, even more than that. The right to self-defense is an inherent right to any country. And when they talked about Security Council intervention, they say that the Security Council intervention cannot be done when there's a case of self-defense. And we have noted, for example, the example of Syria, where they invited Russia to intervene in September 2015. And the U.S. knows very well that Russia is in Syria legally. They are getting help. So Ethiopia has a full sovereign right to invite Eritrea to join in their fight to gain national sovereignty.
Well, the TPLF also attacked Eritrea at the beginning of the war.
Yes, that adds to it, of course. And that would give Eritrea the right to fight the TPLF in Eritrea, but not in Ethiopia. Ethiopia wants Eritrea to help with it, and that's why they're working together. So it's a bit more than that.
The bill would require the State Department to report to Congress as to whether parties to the conflict are guilty of genocide, crimes against humanity, or war crimes. Doesn't this mean that the U.S. government would be usurping the U.N. Security Council's jurisdiction over international crimes?
Yes, in many ways that is exact, although it's more than that. In the case of a threat to peace, the Security Council has the right to take coercive measures if they agree. All right. But the U.S. asserting its right to judge Ethiopia for genocide is a form of extraterritoriality independent of the Security Council. And they cannot intervene in the internal affairs of Ethiopia and or Eritrea. So it's more than just usurping the power of the Security Council. It's totally illegal. And this is something which comes back. The U.S. is using human rights to intervene in the internal affairs. And this has been something they've been doing for a long time, but particularly since 1990. And you know the history of the Yugoslavia and Rwanda. So that's an answer to that question, I think. We have a major conflict in Ukraine. This conflict over Ethiopia-Eritrea may be one of the second most important areas of conflict that are going on right now. And there's no agreement because, of course, Ethiopia is trying to develop itself and assert its sovereignty, because remember, from 1991 to 2018, it was basically controlled from the U.S., and now they're trying to be independent in the true sense, because they want to deal with Russia, with China, with the United Arab Emirates, and so this is the battle which Ethiopia is facing.
Some of the most frightening measures in the bill are those about information control. And these are specific instances of the U.S. and its Western allies' broader ongoing efforts to control information. At one point, the bill says it's going to, quote, ensure the government of Ethiopia respects the rights of all Ethiopians to free expression and political participation. But then it says that it's targeting anyone who, quote, spreads disinformation to further the civil conflict or incite anti-American sentiment in Ethiopia. And that includes the Ethiopian diaspora. This is obviously a violation of Ethiopia's sovereignty and the civil liberties of American citizens. Now, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, American citizens, European citizens, Canadian citizens, United States residents, people living in the United States and Canada, what they're saying, people can speak, you have a right to speak, but if you go against our point of view, then you can be sanctioned or repressed. And this is obviously the U.S. approach to freedom of information.
Is there anything else you'd like to say?
Yes. There's many flaws in this approach. One flaw is they treat the TPLF and the Ethiopian government as equals. Ethiopia is a sovereign country. The army is fighting some kind of uprising, probably inspired from outside the country. You cannot treat them as equals.
That was John Philpott, international criminal defense attorney and Sanctions Kill Coalition researcher and activist. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. This week's show was produced by Polina Vasiliev and myself, Anne Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Anne Garrison. Thanks for listening.